This is the Pop Culture Show. Subscribe and stay connected. Get exclusive video and more at thepopcultureshow.com.
You know, it's not very easy to get into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Our next guest is in. Please welcome from Cheap Trick, Rick Nielsen.
Hey.
Hey, Rick.
How you doing?
Hi.
Doing great. I want to start off and show you, go down nostalgia lane. I've got a couple things to show. Cheap Trick Show and Tell.
Uh-oh.
Ooh. I'm a huge fan. So here's first. We're going to go back to 1982, Corpus Christi, Texas. And there's my
wow.
Stub from my Cheap Trick Show. So that was at that gross Memorial Coliseum.
What year is that? It's kind of blurry.
1982.
Wow.
Cool.
And then here's my, let's see if it focuses on this. Of course, I was up in the front row.
Hey, well, I want that pick back. Come on.
So I have my pick. And at these concerts, the big deal was if you could get Rick's bow tie. And look who caught the bow tie that night.
My God.
No way.
Groupie.
I mean, I had a serious Cheap Trick kind of night.
I tell you.
Wow.
I wasn't trying to pick you up either.
I know. I need to start wearing this during the show, but it's held up 37, 38 years. It's just a little off black now.
Yeah, well, that's cool. I think we sold them for $4 a piece back then. And now
that was yours.
Yeah, well, those were $4.25. Yeah.
You guys have had just such an amazing career, and we're all huge fans.
I got some picks for you here.
Oh, nice.
I mean, for Leslie, not for you.
I mean, Barnes is a fan because he could have sold that stuff on eBay.
Well,
he didn't.
Like,
so
I've never.
Kudos.
This is the truth. The picks I have, I've never sold a pick, and I ordered 60,000 at a time. And it's like,
wow.
Yeah. And but people are selling for a bunch. I'd probably make more money if I'd sold picks.
How many picks do you think you've gone through in your lifetime?
A lot.
Millions.
I don't know. The first 2 years that we were together, people thought my name was Fender. And then after that, I wanted the Fender mediums, like that size. And I don't know. You know, I never thought about it. But it's a bunch because when I order 60,000 at a time. And they usually order at least two times a year. So.
Well, in that introduction, talking about Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Rick, because definitely want to talk about the new record. But I loved watching, first of all, the introduction from Kid Rock.
That was
and
great.
It was almost like, hey, you punks, if you haven't seen, you know, you see a live Cheap Trick show, you better be ready to call yourself a rock band. Do you remember that moment?
Well, yeah,
do you remember that night?
I do, because it, you know, it wasn't rehearsed. We had no idea what he was going to say. And he was spot on. I thought it was, like, funny. It's like talking about, like, yeah, you think you're this, that, the other, and then Cheap Trick comes up. It's like, oh, man. Because we know a lot of these guys, and the guys in the bands, they come to see us all the time. And it's like, you know, they like our band, you know, I think, you know, because we make just the right amount of mistakes, and we don't steal their girlfriends, or, you know, so that's part of the deal. And when he was up there saying it, it was like, I was, you know, I don't like to smile because my dimples show too much, but it's like, when he was up there doing it, it was so cool. Yeah. And oh, Barnes, back to you. What else did you get that night?
Oh, me?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I got one of your guitars. I know you're down to
hey,
like 6,000.
That's where that went.
Yeah, 6,000. When you were opening, we consider ourselves, and we always say we're a baby podcast. We're like playing clubs because of our audience. We have like 12 people maybe that listen. When you guys were opening for bands like Kiss and back in the early days before you broke and you became the headliner, do you have any great stories from those times or things you remember, either good or bad, about some of those bands?
You know, Cheap Trick, we always got along with everybody. It's like, and I mean, unless you were a snob, well, there are some snobs out there, but it's like, you know, it's like we're all in this together, kind of. And we treated the headliners like they were headliners. And we didn't bring a bunch of people and, you know, geek around them and stuff, you know, try to leave them alone. But then after they start acknowledging us or liking us, then we wouldn't leave them alone. I remember almost every show we've done. So it's like, Texas was always pretty good for us.
Oh, huge for you.
Yeah, except
try to guess who your opener. Try to guess who your opener was the night that I was there in 82.
Aldo Nova.
Yep.
Wow.
Aldo Nova.
How about that?
Just a fantasy.
Fantasy, yes. Yeah.
That
yeah.
was
wow.
So he does remember every
yeah,
show.
Well,
that's incredible. What? How is your mind still so sharp? I mean, what are you drinking?
What's your name? Just kidding.
Cubby.
Oh, me? No. I don't know. It's like I remember, you know, sometimes it's like you'll ask me a question. It's like, I can't remember it. It's like something that happened 5 minutes ago. But then, you know, I'm pretty good at memory about that stuff, you know, because I enjoy what I do. So it's like, it wasn't like, oh, God, here we are again. It's like, oh, cool. You know, I'm a lousy tourist, but... you know, it's cool. I mean, the fact that anybody likes you and you're doing what you like to do, how great is that?
Yeah.
We hope to get there someday to that part.
You're doing so good so far, Barnes.
There's so many great stories that you've told throughout the years, and one I particularly wanted to ask you was about working with John Lennon, because you had worked with him on his last record, Double Fantasy. Had you met him before that? Because, you know, you got the call to play on a few songs, and it's pretty amazing.
No, I had not met him, and when we get done here, I'll send you a little video and some stuff from Yoko and stuff, and actually with Howard Stern talking about it, but... I got a call from Jack Douglas, and he wanted to fatten up the sound with John on the Double Fantasy. I don't even know if it was called Double Fantasy when we went there, because it was a work in progress. But it was like they wanted to fatten up the stuff, and they, you know, we're not session guys. We're the guys he had are session guys. Earl Slick, he was the guitar player on that, and he played with Bowie, and he played with... John and really good, but he's, believe it or not, he's straighter than me in the fact of doing being a session guy. And so it was guy to guy, musician to musician, because I called him John, and that was the day that Dax was born. And so we flew from Montreal to New York, and I smuggled in some Cuban cigars to smoke and toast, and I mean, toasted Sean, we toasted Dax, although Dax is still pissed off at me that I wasn't there in the hospital, but my wife gave me a hall pass. But
that's one time you get a hall pass.
Yeah, I know. If it was McCartney, I'd be at the hospital. I'm getting set up in there, you know, the fact that we're going to work on this. We didn't even know what the songs were. We hadn't heard anything in advance. And John and Yoko walk in, and he looks at me and says, "It's you! It's you!" I said, I think he thought I was Ricky Nelson. And but then he got over that in a hurry. But it was cool because we just played. I talked guitars with him, and I talked mellotrons with him. And, you know, it was... I wasn't afraid to say anything, because obviously that hasn't happened yet in my life. And it was just cool. It was like when I was doing the solo on the song, and they were back in, because we all played together. And I came up with a riff, and they liked that, of course. And he said, he was telling Bunny and Jack Douglas and Yoko, he said, "God, I really like the way he's playing." He says, "I wish I would have had him on Cold Turkey." Clapton choked up.
Oh, man.
Yeah, how about that?
Whoa.
I didn't make that up.
That's a revelation.
What did he hear that made him want to invite you to play? Do you know what it was that he heard?
No, I don't know. Because it was through Jack Douglas, you know, because we'd worked with him on our first record, and then he helped mix Budokan. And we had just finished working not long before that with George Martin down in Air Studios in Montserrat, and then in Air in London. And I don't recall the order that we did these things in, but we did Everything Works If You Let It for the movie Roadie. And they wanted it based on Top of the World, a song I wrote for another Cheap Trick song. And then, we did that with George Martin. And I think Jack was doing something with it was somebody else. Maybe it was Aerosmith he was doing. But then he had to work with John, because he'd worked with John before. And he just wanted a heavier version. And it's like I said, I'm not a studio guy, but I play by feel. Sometimes when you can tell when I'm not feeling well. That was a joke.
I laughed.
I want to talk about The Flame. And I got in radio in 1988, and I was playing The Flame every 45 minutes. It was my first gig. And I was a fan of you guys way before The Flame. But The Flame, of course, is probably your biggest hit. Is it true that was a song that you guys really didn't want to do?
By the time we got to doing that song, we'd been offered by the record company and our producer and our management 10 other songs that were the one we have to do. You know, it's like, it doesn't give you much confidence when you're a songwriter and you said, let's get some outside writers. So after 9 or 10 of these, this is it, and it's like, we'd do them because we were asked to do it. And then this one came on. It's like, by then I was like, I wasn't even listening to it. It's like, I said to our producer, I said, you know, this thing sounds like Nature's Way. It's like, because if you notice the intro, it is kind of like that. Well, Richie Zito, he'd played with Neil Sedaka and Elton John, and he could play every song that was ever done, because he was a musophile or whatever, in any key. And he says, I'd never heard that. So when he said that, he was just trying to get around us doing it. So Robin went in, he did a great vocal, I played my part, we did it, and it was a good song. It was too bad that it was the last thing that we heard. Number one, this is the one for you. Number two, number three, number five. We'd done that when we worked with Todd Rundgren, and the record company wanted us to do the song by the Motors, and we hated it. But we did it. He wouldn't even mix the thing. So it's like, at least he stuck to his guns. We didn't, because we did it. And like, this was just, it was like, I couldn't even listen to it. When we do cover songs or do songs by other people, it's usually because we pick it. And, we've done Rebel Rebel, we've done Day Tripper, we've done Songs by the Move, we did Terry Reid on her first album. So we've done stuff, but we can't try to do it at least we came up with the idea of doing it, of doing somebody else's thing. This wasn't, and so the record company, that's gone. Our ex-manager, that's gone. Producer, we don't work with him anymore. It's like, and we're still here. So there you go. I'm glad it was a hit. I felt cool. Remember after the fire, after all the rain, I will be the flame. I will be the flame.
That album is so punchy, and I think it kind of feels like your new record feels a little punchy like that. I think I loved that sound, and that was my college time, and that record, I listened to it over and over again.
Well,
with my bow tie on.
Well, that's it? Just your bow tie? Oh, never mind. Yeah, we make records for ourselves, basically. If we're not happy with it, it's like, we got to put this junk out. It's like, we got to like it. And, there's always, we don't have the luxury of being like Fleetwood Mac going and do one song for in a year. It's like, we do them three takes the most. We're a live band, and we're a road band. So it's like, I don't think we ever heard the final mixes on any of our records, because we get done, it's like, we got to go. We're in Pittsburgh tomorrow and whatever.
So, Rick, your 20th studio album just came out, and I know I hate those cliche questions about longevity and band staying together for so long. And I know Robin Zander has said, with us, it's just all about the music. Is it really just all about the music with you guys? Because again, like, you've just put out an amazing record.
Well, we're not the most popular band around, and we're never going to be the next newest thing, and we can't dance. So it's like, we just, you know, we put out stuff that we like. And then and another one of my quotes is, you know, we've never progressed. And we were pretty good when we started, but we never progressed, or we never tried to be what we weren't. We never tried to be somebody else. You know, we didn't try to, all of a sudden, I'm going to start playing jazz, and, you know, like, you know, I like to have fun, and I like certain kinds of rock music. And, you know, to this day, I've seen Jeff Beck was my favorite in the 60s when he was with the Yardbirds. And then travel on, you know, 50 years later, it's like, he's still my favorite. I went to his house last year, and he let me in.
When you're performing, do you still swap out guitars every song?
Every song.
And what's the main? Can you do two in a row with the same guitar? What's the
deal? Would I do that?
Well, different. They're different tunings, Cubby.
I understand that.
He's got
but
his
every
guitar
song.
Every song. I used to do this. It's how it started in the first place. I hated it when I go see bands play, and if the guy would break a string or be out of tune, they'd stop and fiddle around with it. So I always had guitars lined up across the front of the stage. And it's like, you know, plus I'm a guitar collector, so it's like, I like to show the junk off. And it's like, so, and I started doing that, and, you know, I now have over 500 guitars. But it's like,
wow.
But I've owned about 2,000 instruments through the years. You know, got rid of stuff, traded stuff, lost stuff, this, that, the other. But I started collecting in the 60s and bought my first Les Paul for $65 in Rockford, Illinois, at a place called the A Bookstore. It was 10 years old
then,
and I bought it, and I paid $65 for it. I still have it today. You know, because every one of them is, to me, is a work of art, and it's like some of the art's not so hot, but it's like it's the instrument, you know, it's like, and I'm self-taught, so it's like, I don't know the difference between something really good or, but I have an eye for it. And so, yes, I do play a different, and I don't change my settings either. I'm not like, it's got to be fiddled with. I use no pedals. I'm the only guy that uses no pedals at all. I have a
That's
wah-wah
surprising.
Pedal that up there that I use on one time when we do Ain't That a Shame. That's it. So I just plug in straight and just go.
What gave you the idea to start making the multi-neck guitars?
Well, I saw these other guys that, you know, I had some Gibson double necks I had. And,
but I know, but not like five.
Yeah, I know. Well, originally what I wanted to do is have a six-neck guitar that I could spin in the, you know, it's like a roulette wheel. And right about that time, Billy Gibbons came out and had the free guitars that spun. So I thought, well, they're going to think I'm copying him. I mean, he's worth copying, but I didn't want to do that. So I thought, what's more ridiculous than a couple guy playing a double neck, and he's got another double neck over here. I said, let's make it really ridiculous. So I had the orange one, Hamer made it, with 36 strings. You know, and then the second one I had was a checkerboard one, and it has banjo tuners on it, and that has 36 strings. And so, to be extra ridiculous, I got a five neck made out of Carina wood, and now it has 38 strings because I put a mandocello on one of the necks. And it's wow. It used to be 2 inches taller, but it's weighed me down. It's really heavy.
Cubby, I know you have to go, so go ahead and leave. I'll just put a still frame of you looking like you're here.
Okay, yes, I'm so sorry, but I want you to talk about the MTV days, if you could, Rick, how video changed things, how, and also I want to hear the best venue you ever played sound-wise. I know every room has a different sound, every arena has a different sound. Oh. Can you quickly tell me the best rooms that you've played, sound-wise?
Cubby asks all his questions at once, and then he leaves, and then, and then we'll talk about it.
You'll have the answer next month.
I'll hang up and listen.
Yeah, all right. See you, Cubby.
All right,
so yeah, he makes a good point. The MTV, it really was a time that kind of changed the course of some bands' lives, and you were in the thick of that.
Well, for me, for one, I'm a terrible actor. I can't act. I can react. But it's like, you know, it's like, here, don't look in the camera. And it was like, well, you know, I'm like the Keystone Cops. You know, I've been in a few movies and a bunch of TV stuff, and you know, I can react, like, you know, but I can't act. And it's like, it seems like I could, you know, it's like I could tell jokes. I mean, I tell situation jokes, but I can't even tell a joke. It's like, Tom's really good at it. And how did the MTV, it's like, well,
I mean, did you hate making the videos? Is that, that's
no,
what I'm hearing?
It was kind of fun, but it was like, I was always easy, you know, look at me. I still look bad. I was never a movie star or a good-looking rock singer. I never tried to be a guitar player that I wasn't. I never put a cucumber down my pants. You know, I didn't need that. No, it's like I never wanted to. Although I liked other players, of course, but I never emulated. I gotta be like Keith. I gotta be like Eddie Van Halen. I gotta, you know, it's like, I'm a songwriter, and it's like, I was happy doing that. And you know, I'm happy that I just get to play, and I get to play with really good people.
So you don't think that those MTV days, you wouldn't have cared if they just didn't happen?
Well, it was, the time was right, I guess, but you know, it didn't. I've seen some of the clips on there. I think it worked pretty awful, and everybody. Those clips don't age well, and I was like, it kind of took away a lot of the mystique of music.
And they were so low definition at the time, they don't hold up well now with people on bazillion-inch TVs.
Yeah, and it's like...
But that was a great era. I mean, I remember turning on MTV and just... Oh, I like that. That's a good ringer.
Well, who was somebody, that?
My,
is that
your phone call? But those are my grandkids. Hi, Grumpy.
Oh, nice.
They call me Grumpy.
I love it.
And it's like, well, I didn't want to be called Grandpa because then I feel like Jed Clampett, you know, the Beverly Hillbillies.
Grumpy. That's funny.
Yeah, because I'm not grumpy.
That's awesome.
You know, it's like, and like I said about with Cubbies, like, you know, I know these the kids and stuff, so I roll on the floor and pee my pants just like they do. It's like. It's a pretty neat treat. But, you know, I like to hang out with them. And the question about those videos was...
He wanted to know the best room you ever played.
Well, let me finish the MTV stuff. I mean, I did these things, and it's like... I'm kind of embarrassed about it, all this stuff. It just looks so dopey. And because, like I said, I wasn't good at that. And, you know, like look at the guys that were good, you know, Billy Squire, you know, he loses his career after writhing around on the floor. It's like, you see almost everybody's terrible at those things. If you look back on it, you know, it's like everything on there is like Spinal Tap. You know, it's like overreacting, big hair, this, that, you know. And I was on one time, I was smashing a guitar. I didn't even smash it very well, too. Yeah, whatever. The best room. Some of the House of Blues were some of the better rooms because they were set up with good PA systems. And you know, I've never seen Cheap Trick. I'm always on stage, so it's like. But you know, it's the ones that sound good, and you can hear yourself on stage. You know, because if it doesn't sound good to you on stage, it's like. I've done a couple of things where I hated it, where I'm doing using a rental amp that so I can't get my own sound out of it, and it sounds like crap. If it sounds like crap to me, I don't play as good, and I think, you know, probably everybody's like that. So it's like I like a good sounding room. I've done a couple streams with Dax and Miles and my daughter-in-law. We're called the Nielsen Trust. We've done that. And it's like one room sounded really good, but and then one room is like an echo box. It's like, and then plus with no people in the place, get finished the song, it's like silence. It's like, oh.
Right.
Rehearsal's more fun.
You know, I love when Cheap Trick does classic covers. You guys doing Give Me Some Truth from John Lennon that you put out on Record Store Day that's on the new record, and Rebel Rebel from Bowie. Did you have a relationship with David Bowie?
In a way, a long time ago, I lived in Philadelphia, and we recorded at Sigma Sound, which is the place that Bowie did Young Americans. So we kind of knew people that knew people that, you know, whatever. And then a bit later, somebody that we worked with ended up to be on their tour. And so I went to, was in Milwaukee once. So it's like, and so I walk in, hey, Rick. Oh, hi, David. And actually, Bowie and myself, we were asked to do, I was going to do one side and he was going to do the other side for Ringo. And it was a project that didn't happen. You know, I don't have the patience to barely have the patience to do our stuff, but to do Ringo. And it was like, well, that's an odd combo, but okay. And then we saw each other a few times. But, you know, it's like, unless we're playing with somebody, we rarely see anybody.
Well, especially before, you know, COVID, toured a lot.
Well, yeah, I think we've added it up. We've done more shows than any band, except I think it was B.B. King probably did more. Yeah,
that's incredible.
Well, you know, we'd play six or seven nights a week, three or four sets a night, and that's, you know, that's where you get your chops. That's where you learn how to bang the guitar, not how to break it, because I never did that right. So we got our chops, had songs. Like when we did our first record, we did, I think, 26 songs in 8 days. And so, you know, we ended up with using 11. And so, you know, there was extra stuff. There always has been. Plus, we had places to play. They may have been awful, but we always worked. Let's work at the Jewish temple. Let's play over somebody's wedding. We kind of cringe doing it, but we always lied too. We always told people that we did cover songs in the top 40. Okay, oh yeah, we do. And then get to the end of the night. Where was the top 40? Well, yeah. Oh, we didn't. Oh yeah. You know, if they didn't like us, they probably fire us or never hire us again. But if they liked us, they didn't care that we had done our own stuff.
I think there's two kinds of music fans. I think there are music fans that probably just know a band, like they know Cheap Trick, they know Van Halen, they know whatever. And then there are some that music geek out, like me, and you get into the people and what they play and what instruments they play, what type of strings they use, all that stuff. I don't know if a lot of people know that your son plays drums in the band. And when people hear that, some might go, oh, of course, he just lets his son in. Well, I mean, he was a pretty accomplished studio musician, you know, leading up to that. Is that weird playing with your son?
Well, I didn't play with him when I was growing up. So, with Dax, he was classically trained on piano. And so he, you know, from six on to till he went to college, and I didn't know that he taught himself guitar, he taught himself drums. And he knew theory, and then he also worked with Dick Dale for 3 years, out on tour around the world with him. So I mean, he learned a lot of bad stuff from him.
But I meant more, if I was in a band with my dad, it would drive me crazy.
Well, Dax calls me Rick. He does call me Rick. And when we got Dax, we had him before. He's been with us, I think yesterday was 11 years, and. But he played with us before when Bunny had his back operated on. Dax went out on tour with us, cold, for Aerosmith. You know, he's
That's big.
Really
yeah.
young. And, you know, he's still young because my kids are younger than him. You know, that's right. And so,
it's weird how that works.
So, it is kind of weird. But it's like... Like I said, he calls me Rick, and, you know, he didn't get the job because of me, because I was the last guy. You know, I spoke with him about going out with us, because it was one day. He was going to Europe, and we needed them the next day to go to do South by Southwest, and then the next day do Austin City Limits with no rehearsal. We did played those shows. He knows music so well, and plus now we're playing every song at the correct tempo. Robin and Tom, they had to agree. You know, it wasn't my choice because I was afraid that, you know, oh, it's Rick's kid. No, they picked him. They chose him. You know, I didn't want it to be, well, we had to do it because of Rick. No, it wasn't me, because I'd already recruited, but not for the long run, but Dave Grohl and Chad Smith and Tommy Lee, because they were all available and they all had played with us, you know, one thing here or whatever. And but they'd overplay us and put us out of the spotlight. So, but you know, so there was other things we could do. But in the long run, we needed somebody that could go, you know, on tour for a long time. That's all we do is tour.
I can imagine after the gig, like going to the hotel bar with my dad, being like, "Dad, you totally fucked up. Don't be cruel tonight." I mean, you totally were. Yeah, I mean, it would just be like,
no, he's just a No, Rick knows when there's a wrong note, and so Rick already. I don't go to the bar anyhow. I used to.
We're fans of this new record, In Another World, that just came out. There's some rockin' songs on there, and I have to give a shout out to Julian Raymond, your producer. He's such a he's a great guy. I've had a chance to know him here in Nashville. When you guys are putting a record together, like, is it a group decision on what songs make the record?
Good
How
question.
Does that work?
Let's see. Well, when we're recording, it's like we don't sequence it or put the whole package together until it's done. Because we had worked on it, but then we added Summer Looks Good on You or Here Comes the Summer and Give Me Some Truth. But we didn't have a sequence for it, so we had worked that out. And it was like, and plus, we did the one song where you do it twice. You know, it's like we're doing our own stuff. You know, we're copying ourselves. It's like, but we play with a lot of different styles anyhow, just no matter what song it is. So, yeah, working with Julian is great because he knows our history, and he's a great songwriter on his own and musician and all that stuff. And he was lucky. He asked me to play with Glenn Campbell on those last two records with him. And I've done some kind of session work for him. Plus, remember the bad actor? I'm a bad actor, so I am in a movie with his son, with Max.
How funny.
I haven't seen it yet. It's the only movie that I'm really good in.
We'll be the judge of that when it comes out. We'll let you know, Rick.
No, I'll tell you in advance. It's probably not very good. I don't want to get...
Well, I know our time's about up. I wanted to ask one last question about the song that sent you to the stratosphere. When you listen to the single could almost be country or bluegrass. I mean, even the leads are just kind of like picking, and it almost sounds like banjo. But that live version was just so electric, and it's just amazing how it's not often that a band gets that much recognition from a live record. What made Budokan so special?
Well, probably the audience, you know, that made it special because, you know, we'd had a couple of hits in Japan at that time when we recorded it. Where we had none here, and the studio version of I Want You to Want Me. Remember, I said we'd usually finish and then we'd get on the bus or take off. Right. That was finished after we were done. So it's like I may have brought up using the piano, but it wasn't that honky tonk kind of nonsense on there. You know, we were always a heavier band than that. So it's like, what was it like? Well, I think it's great. You know, you said that The Flame did well, but I think over the long period, I think Want You to Want Me has done more. And we were like, I think they call it turntable hits, like Stairway to Heaven and Freebird or whatever it's like, and Surrender. I mean, it's like everybody thinks it's a big single and all that stuff. It's just, it's continued to play for a long time. And so, you know, to me, like, even success is not the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and that's great, but success is, then we're still doing what we do, and still having a pretty good time doing it. And I'm talking to you guys, and I did talk to Julian yesterday too. There's a guitar over at the Rumble seat that he thinks I should get.
Buying guitars.
Well, I just bought one. The one I just showed was playing there. I bought. I was chasing it for over 3 years from Paul Weller from the Jam. It's the same as that one. It's a Dwight Cornet, which they made 47 of them in 62.
Wow.
Well, I have to tell you that Barnes and I have been doing radio off and on for years. We both had the pleasure of playing Cheap Trick throughout your career. And then I took the leap over to country. I'm at CMT, and we were able to do a Crossroads with you, with Jennifer Nettles.
Jennifer.
Baby, why don't you stay?
So much fun, and you guys were so great, and we have to do another one.
Terrific,
soon.
And it's like there's been a you know, Dwight Yoakam's done it one, you know what I mean? Taylor Swift has done it. A bunch of people have done that, and then there's some bands like Anthrax. They've done three of our songs.
No kidding.
Yeah, and there's a real cool version of Wiedersehen done by. The bass player from look it up. Ellison, I think is his name.
Now I'm concerned, Rick, because you can remember Aldo Nova opened for you in 1982 in Corpus Christi, Texas, but you're forgetting these people who did,
yeah,
did
well,
these songs. I don't know.
I've done about
so
80,
many people
80 interviews in the last week and a half. And it's like, I don't remember, what day is it? I have no idea.
Yeah. And, thank you for the time. We really appreciate having you.
You had to rub it in and I couldn't remember.
I know, I'm just giving you a hard time. But you pulled the Aldo Nova out of nowhere.
Well, that's odd.
Congratulations.
Well, go get the record. It's on Spotify, wherever you get your music.
Great.
It's fantastic. I love the new Cheap Trick.
Well, thanks, Leslie. And thank you. Everybody. Thanks, Barnes.
Absolutely.
I'll throw
you
another
Rick
bow tie
Nielsen.
If I can find one. Here, how about a...
You mean you don't wear those around the house? There you go.
Oh, there
Perfect.
You go.
I've got my own
cooties.
We
need one of those, Barnes. Yeah.
Thank you,
there's
Rick.
Nobody here. All right, you guys.
This is the Pop Culture Show. Subscribe and stay connected. Get exclusive video and more at thepopcultureshow.com.